Thank you. So some of you may know and some of you may not know or be familiar with the Environmental Working Group. So I wanted to give just a little background. We are a nonprofit organization that's really focused on education and consumer knowledge, really, about some of the chemicals that can be found in products that they're exposed to every day, whether it's personal care products, foods, cleaning products, things like that. And so we do our best to really translate some of the environmental health sciences that are going on into useful tips and guides of things like that on how you might reduce some exposures, and then also databases that are sourced for thousands and thousands of different ingredients that are in your personal care products and your foods and things like that, so you can go and search products that you're using every day and get some sort of a score or a rating. So that's sort of a little bit background, but I will just be giving an overview today, I think, of some important issues in food contamination with endocrine disrupting chemicals and other contaminants, and hopefully some things that I think we can do about it. So Pete gave a really elegant and comprehensive introduction into endocrine disrupting chemicals last night, and they are a couple of things that I wanted to focus on with regard to food contamination. And some of that is specifically focusing on exposure to children and why children and developing fetuses might be a little bit more vulnerable and sensitive to some of these chemicals. You know, we talked about last night how hormones control a lot of the genes that are expressed during development, and offsetting that or disrupting that through exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals will lead to different health effects down the line. So children in general are also at risk for higher levels of exposures than adults, and specifically with food. And that has to do with one thing, that they consume more food and water per body weight relative to adults, so their actually intake and consumption is going to be higher. And then, you know, children might have some interesting behavioral patterns when it comes to consumption. They might eat one type of food over and over and over again. And if that is something that happens to be laden with a specific pesticide or a specific contaminant, then your risk of exposure is going to be higher than inducing variety. So there are multiple routes of chemical exposure, and the two other talks did a really great job of sort of setting this up by giving us some ways that we can inhale endocrine disrupting chemicals. The indoor environment is really integral and important in this, not only building products, but also cleaning products. Dermal absorption, we heard a little bit about BPA and used in personal care products. There are several other contaminants used in personal care products that can be dermally absorbed through the skin. Ingestion through drinking water, we've heard a little bit about effluents and how contaminants can get into water and how you can then be exposed to them through tap water. And then lastly, and what I'll focus on, ingestion through food. And I think it's important to keep in mind, we've heard this a little bit, that cumulative exposure to these compounds from all these different routes are going to lead to different health effects. And so if you're thinking about safe levels, maybe from one route of exposure, those are often absent or don't really consider the cumulative effects from the other routes. So this is kind of funny, actually. I wanted to pull up a image here that was either like a word cloud or just a list of all these chemicals in foods, and I was like, oh, there's too many, I can't do it. But two other people have already done this, and you see that they were extremely lists that were really, really difficult to read. We saw this with all the different foods that were contaminated with BPA that were in canned foods, and then Richard pulled up the red list of those products, and you couldn't read any of them because there's simply so many. So one type of monitoring program that does go on is the US FDA has what they call the Total Diet Study, where they monitor 800 different contaminants, and nutrients in food. And then that data is publicly available for researchers to use and assess dietary exposures with. They also have a more specific program at the USDA where they have the Pesticide Data Program, which monitors 450 different pesticides and their breakdown products. And again, that's publicly available. And you'll notice that a lot of these chemicals that are in there that they monitor have broad range health effects, including endocrine disruption, neurotoxicity, developmental toxicity, and they include heavy metals, things like arsenic, lead, cadmium, mercury, carcinogens, persistent organic pollutants, some of the things we heard about earlier, DDT, PAHs, PCBs. and other industrial chemicals like the phthalates and the bisphenols. And it's also important that to note that some of these chemicals will fall in different categories. They can be carcinogenic and endocrine disruptors. So when we're thinking about humans exposed to EDCs through food, I was trying to think of some compelling examples and ways that we know humans are exposed in food simply by knowing that the chemicals are there. And one would be dietary behavior trends influencing exposures to chemicals. So there's a CDC monitoring program called the National Health and Environmental Survey, NHANES, I think that's right. And they monitor urinary concentrations and blood concentrations of several different contaminants, and they also do dietary recall. And so there are several studies that show certain behavior trends in diet consumption, whether it's an increase in dairy or meat, for instance, is correlated with elevated levels of urinary concentrations of certain types of phthalates and things that might be found also in those products. Some interesting examples are one particular class of compounds tends to be used in microwavable popcorn bags. These are perfluorinated compounds. If people who respond on a questionnaire or survey saying that they eat high levels of microwavable popcorn bags actually have higher levels of these PFC compounds in their blood. Another sort of example is fast food consumption. There is a great paper that came out a couple years ago by Amizoda at GW, who studied behavior trends in fast food consumption based on how much fast food you consumed and also the types of nutrients that were derived from those specific food categories, and saw that those had a dose response relationship with specific phthalates that are used in a lot of the food processing and food contact materials used in fast food. This morning, we heard some really great evidence and work on mercury and persistent organic pollutants in seafood and how that is correlated with exposures to not only the high trophic members of the ecosystem, but also the high trophic members of the ecosystem being humans. And then lastly, one example too is that pesticide residues are reduced in children on an organic diet. So there's been a few studies looking at interventions specifically with pesticides and giving children a conventional diet or what they're usually exposed to, then switching it to an organic diet, measuring the concentration of certain pesticides and seeing that they're reduced. And then when you introduce the conventional diet again, those then again go back up in their concentrations. An important consideration, though, I think, is whether or not those exposures can reach unsafe levels. And this is from a group in California who estimated daily intake of foodborne toxins above cancer benchmark values. So they used data from the total diet study to estimate consumption in food. And then for these specific contaminants, they looked at whether or not those risk ratios, so how much you were estimated to have a daily intake, if that was above what was considered a safe level as a health protective level for cancer, it's usually set at 1 in 1 million risk of developing cancer. And so for these contaminants in preschoolers, children, parents, and older adults, with the exception of chloridane, there were increased risk ratios for cancer development based on levels of these contaminants that were found in food and things that people would eat. What's also interesting to notice is that the chloridane, dieldrin, DDE, PCDDs, these are persistent organic pollutants. So a lot of these are pesticides that we've stopped using, but we're still seeing them show up in food products. And so in thinking about how our food comes to contain EDCs and other contaminants, I sort of tried to break this up into two ways that I think about it. One is the intentional addition of chemicals to food. This is the addition of food additives. So things like preservatives, surfactants, flavors, things that are designed to be specifically added to foods to make them more beneficial in some way, either taste better, look prettier, last longer on a shelf. Pesticide residues, so we specifically spray food products for a specific reason with pesticides to reduce pests. Then the other side of this, I think, is the accidental contamination of food with chemicals. So environmental bioaccumulation from legacy contaminants. We've seen this with chemicals that we've stopped using are present in foods. Migration of food contact materials. I think this is an evolving and exciting place where we're starting to understand that there's a lot of what we don't know what's in our food and what's in our packaging. And then food processing. There's sometimes, we don't really know where a contaminant might come from, and it's involved in the process, food processing process, but you can't specifically target to it to a specific area. So I'll try and touch on everything a little bit and dive into some things a little bit deeper. So there's, with regard to food additives, there's actually a website and a database called Everything Added to Food in the US. And I remember the first time I found it and was kind of surprised and shocked and dug through it and realized that on this one portion of the list, there's over 4,000 chemicals on that food additive list. And you can actually sort the list based on whether or not there's complete toxicity data for those foods and you can, or for those additives. And you can see that many, many, many of them don't have complete toxicity data, but they're still used and approved. And a lot of that has to do with something that also was mentioned last night, this policy called generally recognized as safe, where things that have been used in the market for a long time, even though science has developed with alternative health concerns and methods of testing, these compounds and additives aren't reevaluated. So with thousands of these chemicals are approved as food additives, many of them aren't really evaluated for safety. Our understanding of chemicals, how they pose health risks, is changing and evolving, and we should really be adapting, I think, those test strategies to older additives. And you know, a lot of that has to do because something we were just talking about, the precautionary principle. We see value reductions and limits that are deemed safe. We don't really see it go the other way around. So I think I just want to focus on one class of food additives that I think is sort of exciting. From a scientific perspective, surfactants and emulsifiers. The reason I have ice cream up here is that ice cream is one of the foods that they can be found in. And this idea of thinking about gut health as a toxicity endpoint. So there's been a lot of research surrounding the gut microbiome as emerging as a really important component to understanding human disease. And some of those diseases stem from, we heard somebody mention diseases that stem from inflammation and chronic inflammation and how the gut microbiome plays an integral role in that during disease development, including obesity, IBS, and also colon cancer. So we also know that diet and specific chemicals can shift and alter the gut microbiome, many of those being surfactants and emulsifiers. There's a group who's doing some really exciting work on two, which are, I have them down here, polysorbate 20 and carboxymethyl cellulose, and looking at feeding mice that are exposed to dietary concentrations or concentrations that they're approved at to be used as food additives. And what they're seeing is that these mice have disruptions in their gut microbiome, they have inflammation in their gut, and they more rapidly will develop inflammatory colitis and colon cancer. And then a compound that I worked on during my graduate degree, diacetyl sodium sulfosuccinate, is also a surfactant that has a broad range of uses. One of it's also a food additive surfactant in a lot of powdered beverages. And my work was looking at its ability to potentially contribute to obesity. And so there's some work done there. I wanted to focus a little bit on chemicals as food contact materials, primarily because I think this brings in the One Health component really well when we're thinking about a waste perspective, as well as also what the contaminants in the food contact materials, how those can leach into foods and expose different people. So we're talking about things like plastic bottles, fast food wrappers, can resins, we heard about that already, and then a lot of other paper and board materials and some other contact materials you might not traditionally think about. I listened to a webinar the other day by a Danish toxicologist. Her name's Anne-Marie Vanguard, and she studies specifically food contact materials in paper and board and really studies the unknowns in that field. And so she looks at the migrants and looks at their toxicity endpoints for a lot of things that haven't been evaluated for toxicity and then tries and identifies the compounds. But she showed these figures on what different food consumption patterns look like in different places in the world. And so there are places where you see virtually no food packaging and you see fresh fruits and vegetables, limited processed grains and cereals, food canned and packaged goods. And then for some of the diets in the US, what food would look like for families in North Carolina and California, you see truly the opposite, I think, highly processed foods, foods wrapped in plastics and other packages, and then really few fresh fruits and vegetables. And so I think, like I was saying, not only to think about how this packaging gets into the food, but then what you do with this packaging at the end. We just heard about, you know, the amount of landfills and wastewater treatments that are contaminated with some of the chemicals that you can find in this packaging. And so to truly, I think, protect the planet and solve our human health exposure, you can tackle some of those issues looking in this one place. So one class of chemicals, I'll focus on three that I think are important, but they are by no means the only ones. They've just probably been the most well-studied. One being phthalates, which we're gonna hear a lot more about those health effects this afternoon, which I think will be really exciting. But they're used in PVC as plasticizers. There's some use of them in plastics, the lids often in glass containers. And then phthalates also are interesting because I think there are a lot of unknown sources. And that's reflected in some of the monitoring in foods, but really not understanding why they're there. Per- and polyfluorinated compounds. So these are sort of an emerging class of contaminants known as PFAS or PFCs. You've probably heard of them. They're primarily used in food wrappers, paper and board, amongst other things. And then BPA, which we've heard about in epoxy resins in linings of cans, but also I want to mention some of the other bisphenols that are used, not just BPA. So a brief thing on phthalates. They're primarily used to plastics and PVCs really to get properties out of those plastics that weren't originally there, things like flexibility, malleability, and they're not bound to the plastic polymer, and they can leach and migrate from materials in foods. And we know that some of the health effects associated with those are that they're anti-androgenic compounds, which I won't go into because they'll be covered later. But in some biomonitoring studies, particularly in Europe, there is predominantly bread and dairy have some of the highest exposure sources. And in bread, usually this limit is always exceeding what is typically allowable in bread set by the EU. And bread is also one of those things where we don't really know why it's there, sort of where it's coming from. In Europe, phthalates do have some regulations on use and migration limits in plastics, which I think is some of the only food contact material actual legislation. But something that is important to bring up, when they do surveys for a lot of these things, there's often a lot of violations. So you'll find either levels of phthalates that are above the specific migration limits, or you'll find unapproved phthalates in foods that shouldn't be there. So this sort of enforcement and regulation and follow-up is a challenge. To give an example, I think of some of the estimated daily intakes for one specific phthalate, DEHP, which is diethylhexyl phthalate, based on diet and life stage. These researchers took total diet studies, so measurements of contaminants in food, and similar to the first thing, they estimated the amount daily intake that would be based on four different consumption patterns, one being a typical diet based on surveys, one from the USDA based on the guidelines and recommendations on what you should be eating, the amount of fruits and vegetables you should be eating, a high vegetable fruit diet and a high meat dairy diet. And so I think a couple of things to point out is that in all cases, the meat and dairy diet were estimated to increase the phthalate exposure. So that's a potential source that could then also be remediated. And that, like I was saying, infants and adolescents have higher exposure than adults. And you know, in all cases for the infant exposure and in one case for the adolescents, these are above the EPA reference dose. And I also want to mention that the reference dose there is based off of a increased liver weight, which you know we'll hear about might not be perhaps the most sensitive endpoint, especially when we're thinking about infants. The EFSA, which is the European Food Safety Authority, has a TDI, a total tolerable intake, that's set higher. But again, for some of these diets, they're already exceeding those levels that are supposed to deemed no health concerns or no risks. BPA and other bisphenols, so I won't spend a ton of time on this because we got a really great coverage on this, but the use of bisphenols and BPA in foods where a high percentage of the canned foods have BPA contamination. Some of the other things that we're seeing, though, is what those replacement chemicals are for cans that might say BPA-free, and there's some monitoring of some replacement chemicals being BPS and BPAF, which are very similar molecules to BPA. They serve the same function in the epoxy resins, and they also contaminate food in similar ways. And so you can actually see human exposure is declining to BPA, and you're seeing monitoring where you're increasing BPS and BPAF exposure. And again, there's some violations in migration rates. And important to add here too is that there's toxicological studies that identify all of these compounds of acting very similarly in the same estrogenic pathway. And so, you know, we know that between all of these compounds, you're making up 100% of the bisphenols that are used in epoxy resins and the contamination in food. So how do those group together to elicit estrogenic effects? So the PERM polyfluorinated compounds, PFCs or PFAS, these are compounds that are associated with health effects like cancer, immune toxicity, low birth weight, obesity, increases in cholesterol, and some differentiation in sex hormones. And they function primarily as non-stick chemicals, and they're used as grease oil and water repellents in fast food or greasy food things. So a study that EWG researchers were involved in tried to do a market share of fast food packaging in the US and saw that 50% of dessert and bread wrappers had PFAS compounds, 38% sandwich and bread wrappers. You can see how this changes sort of across the board. And what they also noticed was that a lot of these were unknown compounds, so perfluorinated compounds that we don't have really good structure or toxicity data for. So I wanted to spend just a minute on reducing your exposure through diet. And I think, yes, you can, but it's complicated. There are a couple intervention studies that sort of highlight some of these challenges and also enlighten us to where some of these food contaminants might be coming from. There is a study that looked at trying to get rid of all food packaging to reduce phthalate and BPA exposure. And we saw an increase, they saw a dramatic increase in a spike in phthalates in the intervention study. And then they looked at the foods that they used and they found that it came from spices, particularly ground coriander, which in one case had a really high level, and then from some of their dairy samples that they were using. So while their intervention study, that method they were using didn't really work, we found out sort of where some of these contaminants came from. In another study that tried to get rid of dairy and meat, you saw a much more successful reduction in phthalate exposure. And then lastly, with regard to pesticides, I mentioned that they're eating organic, and children that are on organic diets have much lower levels of conventional pesticides. One of the analyses that EWG does and the tips they provide every year is the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, where we look at that total diet study and the pesticide data and figure out which foods have the most pesticides, the highest concentrations, the most detected amounts, and come out with a list of the 12 foods that you really should buy organic and then the 15 foods that you can probably get away with. So avocados and things like that, for instance, have very very limited pesticide detection. And then some other things you can do. There seems there's been some political interest and legislative interest. Recently, there was ingredient use and disclosure bills that were passed, one in the state of Washington that's actually trying to ban perfluorinated compounds in food packaging materials. And that successfully passed with the stipulation that alternatives can be found, which is kind of an interesting stipulation to include in a bill, and I think really highlights the need for innovation, specifically in this type of chemicals. So state and local legislatures are listening, and there's a little bit more room there to make some changes, I think, than maybe at the federal level. So I can leave up some of these takeaway points and take questions if you guys have any. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Alexis. I actually have a question I want to ask you. You showed the packaging of the foods, and I know like meat comes wrapped in plastic all the time. Is that a source of some contaminants? And if it is, is there anything that can be done? Can it be washed off or anything like that?
Yeah, I think it definitely could be a source of contamination. I think it also has to do with the processing, though. So some of it might not be able to be there. With meats, I'm not sure if you can wash it off with pesticide residues. There's more data suggesting that that can be washed off. But that would be a good study to look at how you can treat foods.
Question, Allie?
It's interesting that there's newer materials that they're looking at in terms of food packaging. One of them I had seen was for casein as a packaging material, which concerns me because I think of, you know, food allergies and kids who have dairy allergies. So that's of interest, you know, whether you're getting rid of the risk of pesticides and yet you're adding this sort of allergic potential. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to comment on that. And one other thing I just want to mention, when we think of routes of entry into the human body, I think everyone sort of doesn't really think or kind of consciously want to think about the fact that intravaginal exposure is actually very concerning, especially for young women who will spend, you know, many, many years and many thousands of tampons and feminine products, pesticides, rayon, chemicals for chlorination for cotton. So I just want to mention that that is another route.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, with regard to new food contact materials, I think there's a serious need to, with most things, but really to evaluate their safety before they come to market and look at the product really as a whole, not specific individual ingredients. Yeah, allergens would be a huge interest that's sort of similar to fragrance use in personal care products. There's not, most people are allergically sensitized, but for the few people that are, it's a serious issue.
Well, I've got the microphone.
Oh.
Would the person with the nice blonde hair who just gave a very interesting comment, which did not reach the end of this room at all, please do it again and hold the microphone in front of you like a pop singer, because then I could hear you.
Can you hear me if I repeat it? So she was mentioning vaginal exposures as a source that is sort of overlooked in terms of personal care product use and other product use. But it's really concerning in an organ in an area of high toxicity concern.
What are your thoughts about the cooking utensils that consumers are getting bombarded with on infomercials that are coated with ceramic and the copper and things like that? Are they better or worse than the predecessors?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's probably an area of the market that needs investigation. I think if something says it's free of a certain chemical, it likely has a very similar substitution in it. So I think things that we typically think of as probably the most inert, I don't know, a wood might be better, but I don't want to say that because I learned a little bit about formaldehyde today in wood. So it's really hard to assess it, but I think it's something we can look into, yeah.
Hi, so I just wanted to go back to your comment about the CDC doing surveillance for these toxins. So that's great, and they're doing it at a public health level. And I'm wondering if we should start moving that to point of care more at the individual level, where we can utilize our clinical toxicology labs in the hospitals, especially in pediatric hospitals where these more vulnerable patients are coming in with potential exposures. You know, could we connect that to that individual patients where the toxicology lab could be picking up these, you know, these chemicals in the patient's blood and then kind of bringing the problem to the forefront to the patient or the patient's parents, that type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably worth discussing with some of the medical professionals that are here in some of the breakout sessions. I think this idea of personalized medicine, and if that's something that people are aware of, something they're thinking about incorporating, those conversations are worth having.
So I think the topic of food in terms of exposure is really interesting, especially when you have to take into account the really strong socioeconomic and sociological aspect of it. Those wrappers, those preserved foods, a lot of time that's all that can be afforded by certain groups of people, whether that's on an individual basis or due to historical discrimination. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if your organization or if you know another organization that is trying to incorporate, you know, that kind of information from those fields of study with the, you know, the science part of it, because we clearly have really good science behind it. There's amazing people here today. So I was wondering if you know of someone who's trying to work on that side of the issue.
Mm-hmm. I know there are studies out there really looking at how the exposures are often very disparate, and that those are two things, socioeconomic status and high exposure, are often correlated. I think organizations probably looking at sort of these upstream approaches through legislation, getting them out of materials and packaging is a way to, a little bit of a catch-all, but yes, they work really slowly. So I can't think of specific initiatives really off the top of my head besides really going into communities and educating them and trying to find alternatives that are not equally priced. For sure, it's an issue that's really, really hard to tackle because of these compounded disparate exposures.
I think we have time for one more question, if there's another question.
So you talked a little bit about this possible replacement of PFAS, if they could find an alternative.
Yeah.
And the alternative question is an interesting one because it gets back to this regrettable substitution idea, mm-hmm. which is totally driven by quantitative structure-activity relationships, in the sense that they're trying to have some sort of functionality, mm-hmm. which is why they keep going back to the same.
Oh, sorry,
can you not hear me? So you're looking for the same functionality,
yeah.
so you keep going back to similar compounds, and that's why they're still toxic, because they have a similar structure.
Mm-hmm.
And not enough attention is given to the fact, do we need that functionality? So thinking about PFAS, there was a recent study that showed one of the highest levels was in the wrappers for cookies and Subway sandwiches, right? And the reason that it's in that wrapper is to keep it from getting oil spots,
right.
so that you don't know how greasy that cookie is you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
Are these functionalities we actually need to preserve?
Yeah, I think there's a couple researchers that I know are really working on trying to delineate the essential and non-essential uses of PFAS in particular. You know, it's used as a chemical in firefighting foam, where that might be essential in some uses, not all, but in some uses. But I personally would agree with you. But yeah, I think that's part of sort of this whole, what you were talking about, these domains of different ways of thinking of this regenerative way, and do we really need to do these certain things, like not have greasy hands while we eat a cookie or something. You could use less butter, I don't know.
Okay, well, that's really great. Thank you, mm-hmm. Alexis, I really appreciate that.
Thank you.